This week on Writers, Inc.
I had to write 30 and 60 second television and radio commercials. So I had to be on, get it out, make it clear, make it entertaining, get the message across.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I am J. Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. I am home alone this week. I feel like I'm waiting for Joe Pesci to show up and like break in.
Is it weird?
Yeah, my wife and daughter went to Pittsburgh, probably somewhere near Kevin, to visit family. They go every year. And like, I don't like making that trip. It's fun to like, if I could do that trip for like an hour, 1 hour visit, a couple hours, like an evening or something like that, that would be cool. But like, she stays for a whole week. Mm-hmm. And I can't do a whole week.
You could have been here. We could be hanging out, having drinks.
You would be bored with me in like a day or two too. And then that would be.
Maybe. But what we would end up doing, I know, is we'd find some spot where we both are mutually at our laptops. And then that would just be the entire visit.
Probably.
We'd just be sitting in the same space writing.
I think that's accurate, Kevin.
Yeah, that's what happens when people come to visit me at the house. Like,
I'm well aware.
I'm fine
I'm
with
like,
that.
Where's JD? We never saw him. It's cool.
Yeah, like I go back to my writing room. I do my own thing. And like, you just, try not to lock yourself out.
Now, question. This is terrible. I love being home by myself. It's like my favorite. Do you enjoy being home by yourself or do you miss your family?
I do a little bit, but like now, I mean, they left yesterday and like I'm already feeling like the house seems so big and quiet, like without anybody else here. Yeah. And our routines are so tied together. I read with my daughter every night, my wife and I watch stuff in the theater when she goes to sleep. Like I've got this whole routine down and being autistic, routines are very important. Yeah. So now I'm doing that same routine, but like nobody else is here. My daughter and I were in the middle of watching a show called Amphibia on Disney, and like we're like two episodes or so from the ending of like this three season arc. I feel like watching this little kid show all by myself just to see what happens, but like I can't do it because she's not
here,
right. So like that's on hold. But when I was a kid, I absolutely loved it, because I had a brother and a sister. Mm-hmm. And like when everybody took off and I was home by myself, like that was the best.
It's the best. Did they take the dog too? Or do you have the dog?
No, the dog is at Four Seasons right now, the local pet resort. So he's off being pampered. Four Seasons.
And that's free plug. Four Seasons for all your pet needs.
I'm on vacation. So I went and I got a massage yesterday. I've got two massages while I'm on vacation because I don't do them when I'm at work.
Nice.
I went with my son, and that's always fun because I make the call. My son is 18. And I'm like, just to give you a heads up, he's 6'7". And they go, we'll see what we can do.
They end up butting two massage beds together.
I don't know,
because
he goes in a separate room. I don't know, but they give him the big room. And I don't know what they do in there, but he said it was nice.
The big room.
They're like 6'7". And I'm like, yes, that's not a meme. That's actually his height.
Do they charge extra?
No, they don't charge extra for you being home.
You know who is charging extra? This isn't in the news, but I was reading this about an hour ago. AMC is trying a new program where they're going to charge per seat. Like different rates. So the closer, like the prime seats inside the theater are going to be the most expensive. You take a seat in the far corner in the back somewhere, it's going to be cheaper.
Yeah, that'll get me back to the theater.
Going to blow up horribly.
They're not going to fill theaters then. Or like, I don't know how that's going to work.
They're treating it like a concert. Like the best seats are the most expensive.
Mm. Okay, fine. But then you have to keep all the riffraff out. If I'm going to pay extra to have a good seat, I want to watch the movie without any laser pointers or people twerking or whatever the hell is going on.
We need baskets for your cell phones. Here's my question. Which ones are the good seats? I always like the ones in the last row in the middle. Are those the best seats? What are the best seats?
I like the dead middle of the theater.
Yeah, I think technically the dead middle is supposed to be the best, right?
Yeah.
Our only movie theater, it's a Regal, and it's one of those kind where you get assigned seats and they recline and all that. Yeah. In the handicap row, there's two normal seats that aren't tied to like a handicap seat that you can take. And that's where me and my daughter usually get. And like, they're, you know, like, unless a handicapped person actually shows up, that means we're the only two people in the entire row, I like. So I shoot for elbow room.
I haven't been to a theater in years now, but, you know, we like to go to the, like, I don't know if you guys have iPix or Alamo Drafthouse or any of those. And they're like comfortable, like you're sitting in like really comfortable seating that has like motorized, you can recline and you can, you know, you get a little table for your food and you can order actual like restaurant meals. And at iPix, you can actually get booths, these little pods that you and your, you know, significant other can sit in, and you're completely isolated from the rest of the theater.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's
very nice. Yeah. Those are the only theaters I'll go to now.
I don't remember if the last Star Wars, I don't remember if I saw that in the theaters or if it was the last Hunger Games. Not like the new ones, but like of the original trilogy. It's been a long time since I've been in a movie
theater. I saw one battle after another. I feel like I saw something after that and I can't remember. But my husband drags me out. Otherwise, I would just be a hermit. So he makes me go through stuff.
I like having that pause button. You know, it's nice to be able to pause it and do your own thing.
Yeah, me too.
My husband hates the theater, which is probably why we don't go very often. Yeah. That pause button and then listening to people chew.
Well, some people pay extra for that.
All right, Kevin, what is in the news?
Well, in the news, Barnes & Noble CEO on strategy, book sales, and possible IPO. Barnes & Noble CEO James Daunt says physical books never stopped being popular. The real problem was that bookstores had become bland and cluttered with products that didn't belong. Daunt credited much of Barnes & Noble's turnaround to a surprisingly simple idea: give local store managers freedom. Asked about reports of a possible IPO, Daunt declined to comment, saying his focus is on running bookstores. I, too, am glad that they're giving freedom to these bookstore operators. You should never lock people away. That's my...
Well, I mean, he's trying to... He's letting them do what they want, right? Like ordering, he said, pretended your name over the door, which is cool. You can tailor it to local tastes and your style. And I think people don't like Walmart sameness in bookstores. I don't think that's fun, you know?
There is something to be said for going to a place knowing, like, okay, I'm far from home, and I know if I go to Barnes & Noble, it's going to be one of these three imprints, and I can feel at home there because I've got all three of those back where I come from. There's something about familiarity, you know, when you're traveling. But I love this idea of making it more tailored to the specific clientele in a region, or, you know, treating it more like an indie bookstore is, I think it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, they've captured both sides of that, right? Like they've got, you know, every store kind of looks the same. So like you just said, you can walk into a Barnes & Noble anywhere. It's going to feel like a Barnes & Noble. But at the same time now, they've got this local flavor going on inside of each Barnes & Noble, you know, which makes it, from an employee standpoint, like you see it in their faces. They're happier to be there than they were a couple of years ago. And I think, Kevin, you were the one who found this, right? Like this is a YouTube interview with this guy. And I encourage everybody to get out there and watch it because he's a fantastic CEO. Like this guy has just got the entire business dialed in. He feels like a bookstore, like the way he presents himself, like he feels like a comfortable bookstore, like the way that the way that he talks. He's like a warm sweater. But he's able to run this particular business. But like he has turned around Waterstones, he's turned around Barnes & Noble. The entire approach is fantastic. So like I think you can learn a lot of your business owner just by listening to this guy.
Yeah. Well, I think it makes people want to go. Like, I mean, yeah, you want the familiarity, but when it just ends up being like a cut paste copy, like, you know, I mean, at that point you can just go to Amazon, right? Like, you know that they're going to have all the same things. And so I think like having a bit of both where it's like, you know, you're going to have like all the New York Times bestsellers, like, you know, you're going to know the layout, but then you're also maybe going to be able to find unique things.
Right.
That you're not going to be able to find anywhere else, which I do think is why people go to bookstores when they travel, like to kind of, you know, see what's new.
That's definitely why I go. And, you know, I go to a lot of Barnes and Nobles because sometimes that's the only bookstore in an area.
Yeah.
But I like this, though, a lot because it means that every Barnes and Noble may have a different selection. So there is a reason to go. Yeah. You know, there's a reason to go find all the Barnes and Nobles in the area and visit them. That's one of my little like checklist things when I'm in a, like here in Pittsburgh, I think I've hit every bookstore, you know, within 30 miles of Pittsburgh at this point. And it's kind of nice to see like everyone's different focus, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of fun. All right. So $2 million crime novel deal collapses amid questions over AI use. A major debut publishing deal reportedly worth more than $2 million collapsed after the author's agents said they could no longer verify that the manuscript had been written without AI assistance. The novel was withdrawn from sale despite sparking a 14 publisher bidding war. The agents said they initially accepted the author's assurance that AI had not been used, but later withdrew representation after inconsistencies emerged in discussions about how the manuscript was created. Notably, they said they did not rely on AI detection software, instead losing confidence based on the changing explanations. Author Jerry Fallade denies using AI. He also points out that AI detectors are known to produce false positives and says numerous editors and publishers had already vetted the manuscript.
My biggest concern in this is like they don't provide any examples. Like they basically right. lost faith in this guy, but they don't explain why. And that's that. Do they somewhere?
Yeah, there is. So there, this is a crazy story because there's like articles that have like different bits and pieces. So you really have to like put on like your Nancy Drew hat and like go trawl on the internet.
So Nancy, fill us in.
But so there's one quote where an editor flagged it early in the process and was assured by the agents that no AI was used. And then there's the author is quoted by someone, I forget who said that he used it to verify chemistry because chemistry is used in it and to run phrases to Americanize it because he's not from America. And then that became, I guess, the point of contention was that they were trying to confirm that that was all he used it for. And then the agent said that his story kept changing on what exactly was used. And then the author came out and said he never used AI, but he was quoted somewhere as saying he did. I mean, not for the word.
You can't backpedal away from all that. So, okay, so I'm going to put my devil's advocate hat on because I've seen a lot of this from the publishing side. There are a lot of countries right now where you can't legally publish a novel that has AI in it.
Yeah.
So when you take a novel that's selling for millions of dollars, it's going to be released on a worldwide basis. All of a sudden, these markets, potentially become closed to this person that's stroking this multi-million dollar check. Which is problematic. If you're using it to change phrasing, you know, like if you're from this country and you want it, you know, like you just said, you wanted to Americanize it, I could see that as being a problem, you know, because if it's taking these phrases now, all of a sudden he's using the phrase the AI gives him, he may physically right. type it in or whatever, but that AI is now part of that process. And I can see why they would step back. I mean, it's basically, it's out of caution. It sucks. But you know, they have to look at the fact that they're making a very large financial investment and it could blow up in their face because of this one thing.
His quote was also sort of strange in that he said that the idea, voice, and characters were all his, but he didn't say the words, which is like strange. I mean, and maybe that's just like, you know, people on Reddit were very conspiratorial about that. I don't know. I think you can Americanize, like learn how to Americanize things without necessarily using AI. Like you just can't use AI. Like if you want to be traditionally published, you just can't use AI.
Yeah. But whether he used it or not, there's still these accusations that get levied. And if he says he didn't, they're going to have to prove that he did, or otherwise they're the ones in breach.
But Jenna just said that in some interviews he said he did, and then he walked it back, right?
Yeah.
Well, and also you're going to have to look closely at what their rules forbid, right? So presumably they already knew about these interviews and other instances where he may have said, I used AI for this purpose. They went ahead and started a bidding war over the whole thing, and someone gave him a contract. So I it floors me that you can get as far as he got, all the way to the finish line, and then stopped dead before you can cross, because suddenly it's AI. That's just not the way it works.
I get the feeling this stuff came out after the bidding war, because people don't take notice until the bidding war starts.
Yeah. I think it was when the contract was being finalized, but, and I don't know, JD, maybe you have some insight on this. I did think it was particularly interesting. The agents pulled it, so the editors didn't. So it was the agents, which I don't think has happened before. And I don't know, like that seems, I feel like there had to have been some concrete doubt for someone to walk away from like practically $500,000 payday on the agency side. Like those people are usually pretty money hungry.
There's conversations that happened here that they're not telling anybody about.
Yeah.
So it's very possible he revealed something to the agents that made them uncomfortable enough where they raised their hands and said, hey, we can't get mixed up in the middle of this.
I can tell you with absolute certainty, though, that what this is doing, all of this, this story, the other story with the female author, the stuff with Substack and LinkedIn and all those, it's completely destroyed any trust that most of us have in the traditional publishing process. I just don't think it's safe anymore, because you could end up submitting something, being accused on the most scant evidence possible, and suddenly your entire reputation and career are completely destroyed. It's not worth the risk.
Yeah.
Well, that brings me to a question I was going to ask you guys. Like, what do you, like, if somebody came up to you, you know, your book is on the market, your agent's got a big deal, they ask you, did you use AI in this? Like, what do you have that you could use to prove that you did not? And like, I sat back and thought about this.
70 titles I've already published.
Well, yeah, publishing before AI. Right?
Well, there's that, you know, like, yeah, you've been writing for excellent, but like, just look at that particular book. You know, like I write in Scrivener. So Scrivener has a history. I haven't dug deep into like what that history actually, you know, saves on a daily basis, but it's not like there's a stack of pages growing on my desk and, you know, 1,000 pages off to the side that I discarded and a wastebasket full of printouts, you know, crumpled up. You know, it's not like the old days. I mean, you delete something, you edit something, like the whole book is done within that file. You know, there may be like, I can't remember the last time I honestly printed out one of my books, you know, so like there is no physical evidence of my books. It all lives on the computer.
Yeah.
You know, so like, what do you physically have that you could, you know, provide to somebody else to show them that, that you wrote it?
Yeah. And you know, I don't know. I feel like I should probably look more into this, but I have heard that they can look at your typing and what you've typed. And I used to do about 1.5 million versions. And I'm just keeping it all in one now, because you can look at like the time spent in the document, how many revisions you've made. I don't know if that's enough. Like, I'm like, here, I've done it in this one document. You can see I've been in it for a bazillion hours and made a bazillion edits. And if you can look at my keystrokes, you can see all the mistakes I made, all the times I've gone back to edit.
Every single bit of that can be faked, though, unfortunately. Metadata, tracking data, all that can be hacked and faked. So there's one, you're never going to escape the.
I have no skills, so I don't have.
Well, one of the things that I don't remember.
Maybe I'm going to get a typewriter. I don't know
where I read this, but there was an editor, I think it was related to this, who said some of the doubt came up too in like. Maybe it wasn't this one, but it's your command of also like the story. Like you should be able to talk about like, oh yeah, like I had this one character, you know, like when you're doing a book interview and you're like, oh, I had this one character. And then a critique partner was like, hey, what happened to this? And like, you just sort of like, know, you should know your story inside and out. Because that was one thing where they said like authors who use AI, they have found typically don't have the same command of knowledge of their book. So it's like how confidently you can talk to that. Now you could fake that. Obviously there's like con artists who could like talk through it, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I use different, every copy I make. So it's like, I have like my outline and then I save it as, you know, zero draft. And then I go to draft one and then I go to draft two. And a lot of times I have chapters, you know, where it's, you know, version one, version two.
Yeah. See, that's how I used to do it. But now I don't know. Now I'm worried because I'm like, if I'm sending a final draft to agents, they're going to see like a bit, if it's like draft 24, it's going to look like I've been in there for a few hours or something, you know, so.
Oh, well, I renamed the one I send to agents. So when I send, so when I get a full request, I just put like the title, my name, and then the agent's name. So that I, but so I send them their own copy of the manuscript.
Yeah, but you know, it, they look at, you're sending it in a Word document, right? If they look at the properties and it's just your latest draft, it's going to look like you haven't done anything to it.
Well, I'm going to fill you in on what I did just to make sure I had a means to actually sit down and prove it if it ever came down to it. I know Microsoft Word back in the day, like, you know, it had autosaves. Yes. And from a tech standpoint, everyone knows autosaves is a temp file that exists on the computer. So they're all there, but they're difficult to get to. In Scrivener, Scrivener's got a backup function. So I set my backup function up to create a brand new file every time I backup. So I'm just getting in the habit of doing a backup when I wrap up my writing for the end of the day. And then I've got an individual file for every one of those days that shows the progress in the book. You know, it's tricking ahead to, you know, 1,000 words, 2,000 words more each time. You know, so like I'll end up with a couple, you know, 100 files or whatever by the time it's all said and done. You know, that being said, I don't expect anybody to ever ask me that question because I think it's a stupid question. But, you know, like Kevin had pointed out, like, you know, I've been writing for years. He's been writing for years, you know, like we were doing it long before this AI
long
stuff
before
came around.
AI existed,
And like, you know, Kevin also points out in Wordslinger quite a bit, like the writing process is actually the part that I enjoy and most writers actually enjoy. You know, so if we're using AI for anything, it's to offset the other side, you know, the business, the crap that we don't want to deal with. You know, so hopefully this is going to shake out the bad actors or the people who physically can't write. And, you know, at some point, I think those people need to come to grips with the fact that they are trying to, you know, succeed in a business that they don't have the skill set to succeed in. And they're going to need to move on to something else.
I tell you, though, one of my concerns with this is I have in the past written books very, very quickly. One of the books that I had that's my one of my best sellers that has options for TV, that's, you know, it's a popular book. I wrote it in a day. So what would that mean to people? Yeah. I couldn't show them a work history beyond that day, you know, other than the editing. I guess I could show them the raw manuscript with no edits or something. But how? What's to say I didn't fake that?
I guess one thing I have, and I didn't even know how you'd prove this, but like I have zero subscriptions to any AI. And like, if you looked at my search history, like I don't go to those sites ever at all. And you can, I just learned this. If you type a Google search and you don't want the AI summary to show up, you just like type the Google search, you know, like, you know, new J.D. Barker book. And then you just type minus AI and it gets, so it'll just come up like the old Google search history.
That's cool.
Yeah, but I love the AI and I love all the AIs.
I do not enjoy the AI.
Anyway.
Crazy to go on these witch hunts to try to tear someone down simply because AI may have been involved. Did someone enjoy the work? I know there's legal issues with other countries or what have you, but I think that the default of proof to me you didn't use AI is never going to be beneficial to anybody. But anyway, enough said.
All right, JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Lisa Rowe coming on. Lisa graduated from Syracuse University and spent many years as an advertising creative director and copywriter in New York City before turning to fiction. Her second novel, Big and Lily, is about two sisters who discover the best way to find yourself is by getting lost, and it releases August 11th. Here she is, Lisa Rowe.
Okay. Lisa Rowe, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're happy to have you and excited to talk about your book, Big and Lily, which we'll get to in a minute. But we always like to start at the beginning. And I know for you, it's a bit of an interesting story. How did you get started writing and get into publishing?
So I was raised in a family of writers and artists. So we were always scribbling stories and putting on plays. So I was writing, you know, when I was very young, I wrote my first novel at 8. It was 5 pages long and I don't think I finished it. So, you know, that was sort of something that I always had in my mind. But when, as I got older, I kind of stepped away from writing fiction at all. And I ended up, when I graduated college, going into advertising, which is a very, very different, you know, area than fiction writing. But once I had kids, I ended up becoming a stay-at-home mom because I just thought that my nanny, while I was commuting into Manhattan, my nanny had a much better job than I did. So I ended up staying home. And that's when I kind of came back to fiction. I started making up stories for my kids. And eventually I started writing my own stories. And so I started out writing short stories and prompts. And I ended up writing a couple of novels that were terrible. And my fourth novel was published, you know, when I was 62.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I'm the poster child for You're Not Too Old and It's Not Too Late.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I knew I saw somewhere online you started writing maybe around 50, which is, you know, a bit of a late start to get back into it again.
Yes, although it seems so young to me right now.
I know, right?
Yes, 50 was when I took my first class. It was in the basement of a church. It was just writing prompts. We sat around in a circle on folding chairs and we just, the teacher would give us an idea and we would all write about it. And then she invited me and a couple of other people to take the next step and kind of take another class with her that was short story writing. And then it kind of went from there. Then I did a novel class with her and then I kind of graduated into, you know, doing other types of classes, conferences, you know, all the stuff that we do.
Yep.
And we're trying to learn how to get this story on a page.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's really interesting. And so you said you came from a family of like writers and artists.
Yes.
Was anyone else a fiction writer also? Or?
So my dad was a fiction writer. Mm-hmm. There's a crazy story about my dad. He had a novel that was accepted by Little Brown in the 60s. And they went to edit the book and they said to him, you need to change the ending of this book. And my father said, absolutely not. The ending stays as it is. And they dumped him.
Oh,
because, you know, we all know that we have to learn to take, you know, critique and editing, and we have to be a team player. And he just didn't want to do that. So he ended up, you know, not being published, but he did write a couple of novels when I was very young. On his Royal typewriter, I used to hear the click clacking in the background when I was trying to sleep at night. So it was a cool thing to have a dad like that. And he was also an artist in his own right. He played with a lot of different mediums.
Yeah.
And my mother was a potter, and all of my siblings became professional writers in one fashion or another.
Wow.
Most of us went into advertising and then, you know, did other things. My brother has written movies and my sisters have become painters, you know, so it was really encouraged.
So
no
you were
sports,
supported.
No,
you were supported writing your novels.
Yes, we were. Yes, absolutely. And the imagination was a big deal.
That's lovely. So, yeah, it is surprising to me how many people who end up in writing also like come from journalism or advertising. It seems to be, you know, I guess some of those skills translate. So, you were not doing advertising at the time you're writing. You're staying at home at that time when you started, or
I had left advertising by then. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. I do think that the advertising colored my fiction writing in a couple of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So one is that I had to write 30 and 60 second television and radio commercials. So I had to be on, get it out, make it clear, make it entertaining, get the message across.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, for my voice, works in my fiction writing because I have a message I want readers to take away, but I have to deliver it to them in a way that will entertain them and keep their attention and have them read the next chapter. So I think in that way that there was a through line between my advertising background and my fiction writing background.
Yeah. At least hopefully helps you write a good hook or get that idea pared down to pitch it to.
When I used to do Twitter and I used to do those Twitter pitches. Do you remember those?
I do.
Like 45 characters or something. This was even before the 240. This was like the 170. I don't even remember.
Yeah.
Like, that was my area, you know.
So I'm curious. So when you are ready and you have a novel, how did you go about finding an agent?
Which agent? I've had four
and multiple agents.
In my career, I went the classic querying route, you know, and I will say that I had an agent for my second novel. I got an agent for. She couldn't sell the book and she basically ghosted me and sort of traumatized me, you know, like, oh, I'm never doing this again. I have to quit this business. And then I met an agent at a like a writing workshop that mm-hmm. I had done where the last night was, there'll be a couple of agents and a couple of editors in this room. We'll have a glass of wine, pitch your book. You could talk to them. And I did meet an agent that way. But then I ended up traditionally querying her. And with her came a partner. So this particular agency that I was with had partner agents.
Yep.
And then in the middle of my first book coming out, one of them left.
Okay.
So I was now on number three solo. And then she and I worked together for a couple of years and it was just time to move on. So I ended up with a fourth agent who I will say I didn't query. I was introduced to by a friend, but 300 rejections later,
yeah,
I would say. Yeah. I mean, I did everything you're supposed to do, query tracker, manuscript wish list, Publishers Weekly. You know, I learned how to write the letter, and then I learned how to rewrite the letter. I think I paid someone $50 to read my letter and help me edit it. So, you know, I remember it only too well, you know, yeah. The 300 rejections and what they feel like. And, you know, after a while, you sort of become a little numb to them. And, oh, that's an interesting point, that's something I got from advertising. Is advertising, you have to have a really thick skin because people are picking your work apart daily. So to get these rejections, you know, it was a little bit easier for me. I'm not saying it was easy, but by the, you know, 230th one, I was feeling a little bit better about it.
Yeah, so. You're pretty, yeah. The query trenches are not a fun place to be emotionally at all.
They are not. They are not.
And you do get numb to it. And so I don't know, like when I get them, it'd be like query check. And I'm like, this is going to be a rejection. So you're not even like hopeful anymore. It's just numb. And then when it's positive, it's like, oh.
Right. Like, be surprised.
Shot. Yeah.
And Query Tracker has those little faces, like the
they're awful.
Face, the sad face, the aunt face. And that just makes it worse.
It does make it worse. Those faces are terrible. Yeah. You can filter those out just so you know, so you don't have to see them.
Oh, I didn't know that. Very good.
Yeah, I figured that out. And I was like, no, I don't want to see anything that is a I only want to see positives are still outstanding.
Oh, so very good.
It makes you feel much better when that's all you see is happy faces.
Oh, very good. I like that. Okay.
Cool. So this is, you said you wrote four novels before you sold the first one?
Yes.
Yeah.
My first one is my fourth novel.
Yeah.
Big and Lily is my sixth, mm-hmm. I think. We had some crash and burns in between.
As we do.
Yeah, now I'm working on, as you do, and now I'm working on my seventh.
Yeah.
So.
It's amazing. Yeah, I mean, it's good to talk about because people just say, oh, this book came out and this book came out, and it's like, well, there were these books in between that didn't quite work out or almost worked out. And yeah, you just have to have a thick skin and keep going. So
right. Awesome. Absolutely. Yeah. Build up your biceps and keep pushing that boulder up the hill. That's what I keep telling people. Just, you know, turn off your little brain and just keep doing it and be stubborn and just go.
Yeah. So let's talk about this book now that is releasing as we speak, Big and Lily, about two sisters who take a trip to Alaska.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm so interested. I don't know where you want to start with this, but I noticed when I was reading it, it was called a guilt trip in quotations.
Yes.
At some point, I couldn't help wondering, I'm like, oh, you know, when you think of it, I've taken a guilt trip as a, like an actual trip instead of something metaphorical. I just wondered if that was the germ of an idea for this book or where that came from.
Well, my sisters have a very codependent relationship. They are literally a big sister and a little sister.
Yeah.
And the older sister is called Big by her little sister. It's short for Big Sister, something she used to call her when she was a little kid, and it stuck. And now, even in their 40s, she calls her sister Big. So the title of the book, Big and Lily, is a play off Big and Little. And, you know, the whole like sort of bigger message is the concept of birth order and something that has been sort of in the news recently, which is eldest daughter syndrome.
Yeah.
And I, as the eldest daughter and the big sister, I really wanted to investigate the whole relationship between them. And so the guilt aspect of it is that these girls have a lot of baggage. Mm-hmm. I should say women. I shouldn't call them girls. The women have a lot of baggage that they carry through their lives. And there are some sort of past things, which I won't spoil, that have caused them to feel certain ways about each other. And this trip brings it out. You know, they go to Alaska. So what happens is that they accidentally sign up for this extreme Alaskan survival trip because they hastily put it together. Actually, the younger sister, Lily, hastily put it together when she found out that her husband has been cheating on her. And she had the choice of fight or flight. And she was like, I'm out. I'm getting out of here. And Big, you have to come with me. And for many reasons, Big felt compelled to go and to keep an eye on her and watch out for her, make sure she was going to be okay. So so that is the guilt aspect of the trip. Yeah. But there's, you know, there's a lot of figuring out their roles in with each other and whether they need to keep these roles, whether these narratives that they've been living with all these years still suit them. And I think the trip brought out a lot of the truths about whether or not that was the best way to move forward for both of them.
Yeah, it is interesting. It has been, you know, kind of all over social media, the eldest daughter theory or syndrome or whatever they call it. And, you know, with them being hyper confident and having to take care of each other, like kind of being parentified or, you know, having to take care of everybody.
Exactly.
Organized. And you are the eldest yourself, right? So did you draw from that experience? Do you think, what do you think about it?
100%. I'll admit it. I needed to work out my demons and I let Big do it for me. So I, you know, I say, and I've said this, I write this a lot, that I am a classic eldest sister or big sister. I'm bossy. I'm organized. I'm a perfectionist. I'm anxious and I have, you know, a little OCD, you know, just in the midst of it. So those are all things that, you know, and I'm in my 60s and I am still, you know, mother henning my siblings, who some of whom are also in their 60s. So, you know, the question becomes like, okay, do I still have to be doing this? And I just wanted to let Big figure it out. Like, she should go out into the woods. She should have near-death experiences. She should deal with her little sister and she'll figure out whether I have to keep doing this or not.
Yeah. Do you really need to do this for everybody all the time, right? And then...
Yes.
Yeah.
And do you find that it's interesting that they expect it of you?
Yeah.
And yeah. So if you want to start pulling away,
yeah,
you know, they can give you a hard time. And I find that, you know, when you want to change your narrative, when you want to say, this is not who suits me anymore, you get a lot of pushback from the people who've been expecting you to behave a certain way all their lives.
Yeah.
So that's interesting too.
Yeah. And when it's like, I'm not going to do this for you, then it's like, what?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, yeah. this trip, much like Big, is not my idea of an ideal trip. When I was younger, yes, I used to love to do camping and all that stuff. But now that I'm old and comfortable, I've like the idea of prop planes and trekking through wilderness with, you know, no hospitals. No, that doesn't sound like a good time to me. I don't think I could relax. But you went on a similar Alaskan trip. Do you want to share that? Like,
sure. So I am married to an adventure junkie and he goes all over the world and does all kinds of crazy things. And most of the trips that I've gone on with him have been toned down, you know, mm-hmm. national parks where I can actually kind of, I mean, I'm still heaving and, you know, sometimes nauseous mm-hmm. and whatever, but mostly I can get through. This trip was going to be more challenging. And I decided to say yes to everything. Just be a good sport. Say yes to everything. And it kind of came with a lot of the things that are like my worst fears. I have a fear of heights. Mm-hmm. I have a fear of slipping on ice. I have a fear of walking on stones because the year before we went on the trip, I had slipped on a stone hiking and broken my leg. So I had all these things that I brought with me. And I said to my husband, okay, I'll go, but please don't make us do any of this. And then the second we got there, you can't get anywhere in Alaska without a prop plane. No. You know, everything is these rocks, these, you know, just endless fields of boulders called scree, which are sort of head, you know, human head sized rocks that basically lead up to any kind of glacial activity. So you have to hike over them to get to the ice, which I also didn't want to be at, but we did ice climbing.
Yeah.
And I tried to get out of it. I tried to back out and say, I'll just wait here on this ice cube. You guys all go. I'll be here when you get back. And the guide said, I can't leave you here because there's bears and I legally can't leave you without somebody with a gun. So I had to go up the ice wall.
Yeah.
And I was crying and sweating. No. And I got to the top. I did get to the top. And you know, if any of your audience wants to see pictures of me hanging off an ice wall, it's posted somewhere on my Instagram. But I crawled over the ledge of that ice wall and, you know, kissed the ground and said, I'm not going any further. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I did go on that trip. And when I came home, I thought that is a trip that needs to be in a book. And who better to be forced into the wild like that than two sisters who have a ton of issues that they've got to work out anyway. Let's just pile it on and make it physical as well as emotional and mental. So,
yeah. So would you do a trip like that again?
I would not do a trip like that again. I have done, you know, less. I think my husband was also taking a little pity on me. We now drive around in a Sprinter van that my husband built out. And we, you know, live in the Sprinter van. And because he built it, it's got a toilet and a shower in it. So, and a little corner for me to write in. Yeah. So it's a little bit more lap of luxury than what I was doing before that.
Yeah. That's nice. That's a nice compromise.
Yeah.
So was there anything else about this book that you found surprising or that changed your process or anything else you'd like to talk to our audience about?
It's interesting because I wrote the book, I wrote about 50 pages of the book before I really figured out who the sisters were. And I think that process made me realize that it's never a good idea to rush a book because I think when you get into your third or fourth go and you think, oh my God, that's what the story is. Not that the actual plot changed, but the sisters changed and their attitudes changed and the reasons that they did certain things changed. And I think that you need to take your time if you can, if you're not writing to a deadline, which I wasn't, you really do need to take the time to really find out who these people are and what their backstory is and all that. So that was an interesting exercise for me. I also wrote the book, did a couple drafts, and split with my agent in the middle of it. And one of the reasons was, I don't want to get into it too much, but there's a certain story I want to tell. There's a certain voice I have that I want to use and tell. And I'm kind of committed to it. And I just think that if I have to walk away from that voice in order to get published, I'll walk away from publishing, which is sort of an obnoxious thing to say because some people are trying so hard to get into it. But I do think it's really important to be your authentic self and write what is meaningful to you in a voice that resonates with you to a story that is important to you.
Yeah.
So that was a big learning lesson because I had written a book that was a little bit dictated to me by a previous publisher prior to that. And it just didn't work out for obvious reasons. So.
Yeah. And I think like voice is the most important and elusive and thing that is most wholly yours. So it's hard to find. And once you have a voice for it, whether it's your own voice or your character's voice, it's hard to change. So yeah, I can totally see that. So yeah, I definitely think that sticking to your guns about voice is important. So
I think so too. Yeah. And I think it is hard to find your voice and it's hard to teach voice. which I think people would love to be told, how do I make a voice? And I don't think you can. I just think you have to be honest with the page.
Yeah, I think you have to find
vulnerable.
I always struggle with that because I don't really, I guess it's different for every book I write, and you kind of have to find your character voice. And sometimes I have to write the first three chapters over and over and over. And I don't know if you've had, just recently I was working on the book I'm working on now. I was 30 to 40K in and just like, I don't have it. And then I was like, oh, I got it. And I stopped, I think about 40K and went back to the beginning. So, I mean, that happens too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
and that's what I'm talking about. Like you have to give yourself the, you know, the word count to get there. So one of the things that I did when I was struggling with my voice is I switched to writing in close first person. Mm-hmm. And for me, that really helped. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's certain things we can do that that will help us find it. But yeah.
It can be easier to find in first person for sure. It can be easier to find. Yeah. Third person is a little more remote and sometimes harder to find the voice. So.
Right. But then in first person, you're locked into certain things.
Yeah.
Your character always has to be in the room.
Yeah.
You know, you have to make sure your perspectives are exactly, you know, right on. And that can limit you a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I'm also curious, I know it said on your website that you're also dyslexic, which a surprising number of authors are also dyslexics, but fantastic storytellers. Yeah. How does that affect your process or your voice, or what do you think?
So I have a genius daughter and a brilliant sister who are both basically my editors. So if I miss something, they will help me. But I will say that over the years, I have really learned to kind of overcome it, I guess. Mm-hmm. I was just awful, particularly in school. I can't believe I got through school. You know, I went to school when they just let you, you know, sail through and didn't pay attention to you anyway. But because there was no special education when I was in school. So I think over the years of making a lot of mistakes and kind of really embarrassing myself in a number of situations because either I wasn't paying attention, I couldn't comprehend what somebody was saying to me because that was part of my dyslexia, which was my inability to comprehend things that were said to me. It was sort of auditory, and my listening skills were terrible. Mm-hmm. And so that stuff I worked on really hard for myself. And I feel like, look at me, I've got a vocabulary. I know how to spell things now. I could put a sentence together. I can't tell you what a past participle is, but I can put a sentence together. Oh, good. I don't know. Thank you. But my sister knows, so she can help me.
It's always good to have great like alpha and beta readers and editors. And, you know, it's not a solo project as much as sometimes we'd like it to be.
Yes, never.
Yeah, great. So just as we're wrapping up here, we have one question that we'd like to ask everybody. If you could offer some advice to newer or aspiring writers, what might it be?
I have so much advice, but we don't have time. I will say work on finding your voice and really work on being authentic. And, you know, don't worry about who's going to read it right now. Just work on telling the story the way you feel. Because I do think a lot of people will read their favorite author and then try to imitate them. And I just don't think that that is going to help you discover your own voice and therefore tell your own story. So that is maybe the main one for people who are really just starting out.
So I thought this was interesting. You know, she got started using writing prompts a lot.
AI. No, sorry.
No.
Like, I guess I used to do that when I first started too, but I haven't used writing prompts for ages. How do you all feel about writing prompts? Do you use them?
I bought a book that had writing prompts years ago. I mean, like probably 25, almost 30 years ago, thinking that this is going to kickstart the first novel. And I didn't get anything out of it. You know, like it was all like none of like everything that it put in front of me, like it didn't feel like a real book. It didn't spur any kind of, but you know, I'm sure for some people it works. I know there's card games that you can play to spur that. There's a lot of stuff along those lines, but I've never tried it.
I think writing prompts work really well, like for short stories. So I have used them before in the past, and sometimes, you know, because I subscribe to like Readzy, and so they do a contest every week. And I haven't participated in it, but you know, it says the prompt. And I have noticed that sometimes that it just kind of gets you thinking, like, oh, if I wrote a short story, or even sometimes with a novel, and like, you know, I mean, I'm sure we all have that notepad app in our phone where it's like, you know, idea, and you just kind of like put it in there because you're not sure what to do with it. And I think like it can help in that sense sometimes for me.
I've never been well, I have used writing prompts in the past, mostly for like journal entries though. But even that, I get too bored with it. Like they're always kind of the same. There's nothing all that creative about them. And then I rebel against it and start, you know, writing something completely opposite or whatever. But I do think that they're useful if you are. I like the idea of maybe using it. I could see doing a challenge. I've done things like this in the past. I haven't done this specifically, but like I'm going to write a short story every day for 30 days, and I'm going to use this book of prompts to do it. If you wanted to do something like that to stir up like interest in your work or maybe spark some new creative ideas or something, I think that would be very useful for something like that.
Yeah, I like it. I think they're kind of challenging, like, you know, to write, to kind of come up with something, particularly short stories, because now you have like a goal. Like, can you write a 1,000-word story on this like prompt that you've never thought of before in your life and like make it sound good? And, you know, I do think sometimes, you know, I think sometimes deviating a little bit from like your writing routine can help your actual, like, if you're writing a novel, can kind of help stir up whatever needs to go on in your head.
All right, give me 500 words on broccoli. Go.
Okay. I'll have that to you. Can't do it right now, but I'll get it to you.
Everyone thought they were safe until the day broccoli became sentient.
Hey, lettuce is attacking right now.
That's
It
true.
is. Diarrheal lettuce may be the number one threat I face when out in the wild right now.
I liked that she published at 62.
I
Like,
know, that's awesome.
yeah, that was, you know, you hear so much about, you know, the young, intrepid 20-year-old that gets the six-figure deal. It's nice seeing, you know, hearing, especially when, you know, as Kevin said, there's everyone kind of gets so jaded with publishing. It's sort of like, okay, like, yeah, like people get published every day. People are published all through their lives. Like, your journey is your journey. Your story is your story. Like, if you want to write, just write.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, even getting published later in life, it was interesting that she changed agents because she didn't like what they were saying. She's like, I would rather not publish than change my voice, which is pretty cool.
That's bold. I mean, you know, that's
Yeah.
because you feel like when you get an agent or when you get a contract, you know, you feel like, all right, that's it. I finally made it.
Yeah.
And then you're throwing it away because you don't want to change your voice. You know, that's a bold thing
It
to
is.
decide you're going to stick with.
Well, it seems like it runs in their family because her dad lost that deal because he didn't change the ending. This might be a JD only question, but I'm just curious. Have you ever lost a deal or walked away from an agent because you refused to change something?
Oh, that's not a JD only question. Go ahead, JD.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I mean, when I was querying on the fourth monkey, I had so many of them that told me that I should take the diary entries out of the book and turn it into a straight up police procedural. And I didn't want to do that, and I walked away from some really, really big name agents just because of that. I mean, yeah, it worked out, and you know, it makes me wonder what would have happened if I had followed that advice. But I mean, walking away from an agent like that, you need to have that in mind, I think. Like when you sign with them, they're so hard to get. You know, you get one, you feel like you have to do everything to cling on to that person. But you have to realize what they're really there for. They're there to sell you, they're there to sell your work. And if they're going to change you or change your work, then they may not be the best fit for you. You know, and an agent is also, you know, it's very much like a marriage, even longer if you think about it, because you can't break up with an agent. You know, like I'm on my third or fourth agent at this point. My first and second and third agent sold some books, the other one sold other ones. So I'm in touch with all of them. They all have to work together. You know, so like you want to have the right people in your life.
I've had a couple of different experiences. I mean, my first publishing deal, the very first contract I ever signed, I ended up buying it out for various reasons. But and I thought my career was over at that point. But then years later, after I'd already been publishing for a while, I had several people approach me trying to effectively buy my catalog. You know, they'd cut me in, but they would take it over. And some of those deals sounded pretty good, but until one of them was like, you know, we want all your science fiction titles, and we'll, you know, give them brand new covers and new layout, and we'll market them, and you'll get X percent. But we want you to do a major rewrite of every book in this series, and we want it to go in this direction. And it was good money, but because it would have been a big chunk of money per book. And lots of books, but I decided it, you know, I didn't want to change the stories. I wanted to keep the integrity of it. And so I turned it down. So
those publishing rights, I don't want to get off too far into the weeds, but I really think that we're going to see that kind of thing grow over the next 10, 15, 20 years, because it's happening a lot in the music business. You know, guys like Bruce Springsteen, you know, like big names, the Beatle catalog was one of the first ones. Michael Jackson bought it. And it was the most, you know, prized thing in Jackson's, you know, property that he owned. Like, he made more money off of that than he did some of his own music. But like, publishing rights are huge. And, you know, if you think about what happens to a lot of authors when they pass away, like, their publishing tends to disappear. You know, because there's nobody there to champion it anymore. So I think you're going to see a lot more authors say, okay, you know, I'm retiring. Here's my catalog. Here's the price tag. Who wants it?
In my will, JD, my wife has explicit instructions to call you when I die to ask for your help.
I better unblock her phone number then.
Oh, no. Oh, I guess we're running out of time. So with that, I'll ask JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got number one New York Times bestseller Alexandra Bracken coming on. Alexandra sold her first book in college and later moved to New York City to work for a children's book publisher, first as an editorial assistant, then in marketing. After 6 years, she decided to try writing full time. Her latest novel is called Immortal Rose. It's a slow burn fantasy romance releasing August 18th. Alexandra Bracken.
Yeah, that sounds fun. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode, and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.